So, ladies and gentlemen, a very warm welcome on a very cold evening here to the LSE to what I will guarantee you to be a very lively debate. And the reason why I can guarantee that it'll be a lively debate is, of course, that we have a bit of a controversial topic, but also because we have a very excellent panel of experts to debate what's ahead for Europe in 2017. Will the EU survive? Before I introduce our panel, though, I'd like to make just two very short comments. One is that this event is organized between the LSE's European Institute and the UK in a Changing Europe. Both the LSE and the UK in a Changing Europe have produced a lot of reports, blogs, articles, events on Brexit in the run-up to the referendum in June, but also subsequently, and we will continue to do so on politics in Europe and on the UK situation. So unlike the government, who will not give a running commentary, we certainly will. analysis and commentary on political events unfolding on the continent and here, and I will very much encourage you to follow our work online. The other very brief comment is to say that in this day and age, all our panelists are, of course, on Twitter, and if you would like to tweet about the event, the hashtag is LSE Europe. But to come back to our panel, so I'm very pleased that we've been able to get some of the best positioned experts to take us through some of the major political events that are to happen in 2017. Of course, 2016 is not quite over yet. We have two major events happening before the new year starts, with Austrian presidential elections and a referendum in Italy, which also could result in an election. But nevertheless, I would like to, with this panel, to look ahead for what comes up in 2017 on the continent. So I have therefore asked our panelists to reflect on this in their respective countries or areas of expertise. And I can therefore briefly introduce them before we simply get started with the debate. Michael van Holten, who sits immediately here, is a former MP for the Dutch Labour Party and a former member of the European Parliament. He's currently an independent consultant based in Brussels, as well as a senior visiting fellow here at the LSE European Institute. So Michael has agreed to give us his views on some of the things ahead for the Dutch elections, but also the broader political picture as seen from Brussels. Philippe Malier is professor in French and European politics at University College London, and he's a frequent contributor to The Guardian and to various other media outlets. Philippe has, as you can imagine, agreed to comment on the French elections and what that will mean for Europe. Bojan Panczewski is the EU correspondent for the Times Sunday, for the Sunday Times, and is based in Brussels, but covers Europe in general, and has very extensive experience from a number of European countries, including Germany, Austria, and Central and Eastern Europe. Tonight, Bojan will mainly comment on the German elections and what's ahead for Europe from his perspective. Agata Gostinska-Jakubowska is a research fellow at the Center for European Reform, and she has written extensively also on Central and Eastern Europe. Of course, as many of you will know, Agata is Polish, and she will mainly focus on Poland tonight in our debate. But we will also cover questions regarding the Czech Republic, for an example, which is due to have an elections in the autumn. Sorry, I'm a bit out of breath, but I'm pregnant, as you can tell, and therefore sometimes I have to breathe a bit more deeply than usual. But last And not least, Professor Anand Menon is professor in European politics and foreign affairs at King's College, just around the corner. He's also director of UK in a Changing Europe, and I'm very pleased that Anand has agreed to talk to us about the UK position, Brexit, and what we could expect the British government to do, granted the developments on the continent. So without further ado, over to the panel, and I'll start off with Michael. I think it's
maybe easier to sit down. From here, yeah. Okay, well, thank you. Thank you very much, Sarah. I got a bit nostalgic here in the sitting in the old theatre. I was a student here in the late 80s and early 90s, and I finished my LSE career at the time as General Secretary of the Students' Union, so I used to stand here and face an audience that was a lot less friendly than you all look on a weekly basis. And this was also a time when Europe was still popular with a lot of people. There was a thriving European society, maybe there still is. But it was also a time when the first signs of Euroscepticism were starting. The Bruges speech, Thatcher Bruges speech in 1988, where she distanced herself from the evolving European integration process. Alan Sked founded the UK Independence Party while I was here at the LSE. And The Sun published its famous headline, Up Yours, Delors, which in retrospect seems quite a docile headline if you compare it to some of the headlines that you see in the British press today when it comes to Europe. And in retrospect, I think, of course, we didn't realize it then, but that was the end of an era. And when I look back at the process of European integration, I now divide it into three big phases. So the first phase was the phase that ran up to that period, through the early 90s, which was sort of unimpeded integration, no questioning of what was going on, taking big leaps forward without really meeting any resistance. And that kind of changed with the with Thatcher's attitude to Europe, but also the Danes, the French, who almost rejected the Maastricht Treaty in a referendum. That was the end of an era. The next 20 years, so 91 to 2010, we saw the process slowing down. We saw enlargement taking place, but a watering down in terms of integration. So there was rapid change, but not in terms of what the union allowed itself to do. And then we have the period since the start of the financial crisis until now, when really you could say there is stagnation, there is very little happening, and in fact we see the first signs of disintegration in the EU. And I think we can say that the EU is in an existential crisis. So the title of this lecture, I think, is entirely justified. I think we really have to ask whether the EU will still be around in a number of years' time. And I want to just mention three challenges that I think the EU, three types of challenges that the EU is facing. The first is challenges which are of a national political character. Of course, we've had Brexit in the UK. Anand's going to talk more about that. In my own country, the Netherlands, the Dutch voters rejected an association agreement with Ukraine, which you know, people who aren't Dutch, even many people who are Dutch, may find strange to understand, given the Dutch tradition as a trading nation. And then we've got the Austrian elections coming up. We've got a big crisis still ongoing in Greece. We've got the Italian referendum. And we've got a range of elections coming next year, which pose a potential threat to the EU. Now, in the Netherlands, we've had for a long time a populist movement, mostly on the right but also on the left, of strong disagreement with the EU. That goes back, I would say, to 2002 and the rise and fall of Pim Fortuyn. The big question is what will happen in these elections that are coming up now. We could see a repeat of the 2012 elections, when the Freedom Party, the Wilders Freedom Party, was extremely strong in the run-up to the elections. But in the months and weeks in the run-up to the vote, voters went back to the stability of the mainstream parties and then re-elected the Prime Minister Rutte. We could see that happening now, or we could see maybe the Netherlands following what seems to be a trend now, Brexit, the Trump election in the US, and voters finally opting for a political party that says it will change the way things are done in Brussels. Frankly, it's very hard to predict what will happen. If I had to put my money on it, I would say that I think that the first scenario is still the more likely one. I think the Dutch have had their populist experiment. The PVV has supported the government from the parliamentary benches. That hasn't been a great success. So I think there's some more experience with having a populist government, populist in power, than there has been in other countries. But you know, after everything that's happened this year, who knows? The second major challenge I think we're facing is the external challenge coming at the EU. First of all, of course, the Trump election in the US, and secondly, Russia. When it comes to Trump, again, the jury is out as to what exactly is going to happen. But if we take him at his word, then some of the things he said he will do are the diametric opposite of what the EU stands for. If you look at, for instance, climate change, if you look at his trade policy, if you look at his approach to multilateralism or the lack of an approach or his policy of the Middle East. Without the US as an ally in all these areas and even perhaps as an opponent, what will be the role left for the EU? And when it comes to Russia, a bit closer to home, we see, of course, that the Trump rhetoric is already creating a space for Putin to become more aggressive, both physically in terms of what he threatens to do with his armies, but also in terms of the propaganda that Russia is using to influence things in the US, but also in Europe. We see that he's beginning to pose a fundamental threat to our safety and winning allies within the EU. The Bulgarian presidential example is a good recent example. But you also see the leaders of far-right and far-left political parties in the EU increasingly expressing sympathy or admiration for Putin. And I think that poses a real threat to the EU's foreign policy. And finally, the third challenge I think we're facing in next year is Brussels itself, which is in flux. The European Commission has had its wings clipped by the 2014 European elections. Juncker has talked about a last chance saloon. The Commission is, in a sense, trying to keep a low profile, but there's nobody else to fill that vacuum. The Council is looking after the interests of member states, individual member states, and there isn't a coherent approach to take the EU forward. The EU is moving from crisis to crisis. Brussels has become a big crisis manager, and it doesn't really even know how to do that very well. Because the prime example now is Turkey, where the migration crisis has been solved more or less by this deal with Turkey, but now we're facing the problem that the repression following the coup in Turkey is undermining support for the enlargement talks, and the EU doesn't quite know what to do. It's caught between this realism, geopolitical realism of sticking to the Turkey deal, and on the other hand, defending the values that the EU stands for. And you can think, rightly ask, as the European Parliament did last week, you know, what's the point of the EU if we don't stand up for those values? And finally, ethics, where, you know, Barroso going to Goldman Sachs, but also the failure to deal with the Oettinger crisis. For those of you who follow that, the German commissioner who's questioned on a number of grounds for his pronouncements and his behavior. And if Europe isn't seen to act on those, then I think it's understandable that people develop a distrust for Brussels. So what to do? First of all, I think obviously we need to listen, but also act on it. We're always analysts and politicians very good at saying that we should listen to the people, but not very good at actually acting on it. So I think there needs to be some major changes. And I think one is that the EU needs to look at its structure, make sure that we develop a structure for the future that allows countries like the UK, but also Turkey, to be part of a European family of nations without forcing policies and ideas down the throats of people that they don't agree with. So that requires a different structure. We should probably also stop TTIP if Trump doesn't stop it himself. We should stop and pause and think whether TTIP is the right thing to do at the moment, and certainly develop a better context in which to implement it if we do go forward with it. Secondly, I think we should stop salami slicing when it comes to Brussels policies. Let's try and make Brussels more streamlined and look very critically at what the core policies are it should be pursuing and get rid of the other ones. For instance, this whole machinery of regional subsidies, I think, is a big hindrance to when it comes to making clear what the EU should be all about. Then I think it's up to national leaders to stand up and make the case for Europe, something that's been seriously lacking in the last few years. In my country, the Dutch Prime Minister Rutte only really started defending this Ukraine association agreement after it was rejected by voters. He should have stood up much sooner and said what the value was for the Netherlands, but also for Europe, of having this deal and what the consequences were of not having it. We need leaders who are prepared to stop bashing Brussels and say why Europe is important, because otherwise I think we are lost. And finally, I think in terms of the institutions, now that Schulz is leaving as president of the parliament, we have a golden opportunity to reassess who should be leading the various European institutions and whether the right, the people that are there now are the right people to do this, are the right people to take Europe forward at a moment of grave crisis. So I've run through all of this in at sort of breakneck speed. I hope I've given you some thoughts about that. On the question, you know, that's put to us, can the EU survive 2017? Yes, and I think, you know, on balance, if I had to put my money on it, it probably will. But I think there's a grave danger that it won't if we don't take the steps that are necessary. And I think one way that needs to be done, you know, I've talked mainly now about what politicians need to do, but I think what we also need is a popular movement. We shouldn't be naive about this. This is a strong political movement that is trying to undermine everything that we've achieved in Europe in the last 50, 60 years. And without a strong popular movement to support working together in Europe, we're not going to get there. I think if you look at the Tea Party movement in the US, which eventually was successful in electing Trump as president, you know, the same could happen here. And if people who believe in international cooperation and European cooperation don't stand up for that belief and don't fight for it, the other side's going to win. So it's extremely important that it's not just left to politicians to try and determine our future, but that young people especially get involved as well.
Okay. Thank you so much, Michael. I think that your point about the Dutch having had their populist experiment is a really interesting one. And, of course, we then have to consider to what degree their messages have now been submerged into mainstream politics and the debate there. But clearly there is something else going on in the Dutch political landscape than some of the other countries will now turn to. So let me go to you, Philippe, please. We've, of course, just only seen the results from the Conservative primary, but what is ahead for France?
Well, good evening, first of all. I'd like to answer the question straight away with a yes or no type of answer. Will the EU survive in 2017? I think there's an extreme case scenario, which is if Marine Le Pen wins the next presidential election next May, the answer will be no. But she's not there yet. I don't think that she will win it. However, who knows now? Because first point I'd like to make is that the French political situation is extremely volatile. So it's very difficult to predict, in fact, what will happen. We're probably on in France for a kind of US-style type of election with lots of upsets and surprises. We saw already the primary election for the right, for the conservative right. Fillon, who was for a very long time largely behind the third man and came from behind to win the race very largely. So who knows, because clearly, and that's one of the points I will make briefly, is that there's very anti-elite mood in France going on, and of course it impacts also on the stand and how the French relate to the EU in general. So very volatile, that's the situation. Of course you might think there've been a number of major terrorist attacks, of course, that has reflected, you know, created a climate of fear, but I don't think that's enough. I think essentially the mood of fear, distrust, has deeper roots than simply the terrorist attacks, although they've played a role, as I said. I think essentially it has to do with the persistence and the depth of the economic crisis, which France has known. France, you know, since its revolution, has been a country which very much politics is very much based along, class lines. You know, it's about, you know, equality. It's about social redistribution. And hence the critiques of Brussels, the EU, are very much along those lines. Debates about sovereignty relate also to the question of a Europe which, rightly or wrongly, doesn't seem to be doing enough for the ordinary people, as opposed to markets or big business. That's very much the French take on the EU. I'd like to make four points very briefly. First of all, talk about the crisis of the French political institutions. That's a very major point if one wants to understand the sort of discredit of, I would say, virtually the whole of the political class and the institutions of the Fifth Republic, de Gaulle's institutions, which have been set up in 1958. For a very long time, they were seen as good, efficient, working fine. Now they are seen essentially as unfair, undemocratic, granting far too much power to one person, the president, deemed a monarch, a republican monarch, elected every 5 years, but once he's elected, virtually politically irresponsible. That is, he can do almost whatever he wants. Of course, the incumbent one is going to pay dearly what he's done over the past 5 years, because I think Hollande is clearly politically dead. But we still don't know whether he will run or not. That's the other uncertainty. I think to explain Hollande's deep unpopularity, I think the latest polls I was seeing yesterday was that he would be credited of 7% of the share of the vote nationally if he was to run in the next presidency. 7%. Normally an incumbent president gets at least 25-30%. He would be ranked in fifth position, so he would be eliminated. What's more, there is normally a socialist primary election we should be organized in January, and now the talks are, after saying that he would participate in it, if he runs again, of course, would be that no, he might not take part in it. Why? Because he might lose that primary election within his own party. So you see how weak the president is. It's totally unheard of. Normally presidents, incumbent presidents, run again. They can be defeated. That was the case of Sarkozy in 2012, Giscard d'Estaing in 1981, but cases of an incumbent president who's sort of not being able to run because the risk of losing in the first round are such that is totally new. I think there are several reasons I can't really develop, but I think there are problems with the French political elite, which appears to me totally stale. You know, political careers in France stretch over very long periods, decades, 20, 30, 40 years. You lose elections, but you stay put. Sarkozy, defeated in 2012, said, "I quit politics." That lasted 2 years. He came back. Of course, no one wanted him back, so you saw what happened to him. So there's a lot of things, plus the sexism, the lack of parity, also in the workplace and politics, and what's more, the lack of representation of racialized minorities in France. Big problem, notably second, third generation of immigrants, sons and daughters of immigrants from North Africa. I think there's a big issues, racism, Islamophobia in France. Second point is the uncertainty regarding the future of the French party system. Of course, that's a sort of one of the consequences of the rejection by an increasing majority of French people of the political institutions. They do not regard those parties representing them as, representing them well. So that's why outsiders on the far left and right and far right seem to have an opportunity, a window there for them to sort of make political games. The state of the Parti Socialiste, the Socialist Party, is very worrying indeed. I can even talk about a kind of PASOKization, the PASOK, the Greek PASOK. You remember what happened in 2011, the sort of progressive slump, a party which received over 40% of the share of the votes in the 2009 election, and 5-6 years later now it's below 5%. I'm not saying the Socialist Party has reached that low point, but it is really going there at the moment, really, really going there. It has lost all elections since 2012. It was a party which was dominant in 2012. All local, regional, national elections, the only majority it still gets, because there hasn't been a new election yet, is the majority in the National Assembly. It has lost the Senate, it has lost the regional elections, has lost the municipal elections. It's a complete disaster for this party. The radical left, because there is one in France, I think one of their declared candidates, Jean-Luc Mélenchon, already a contender in 2012, is running again, and he's credited of between 12 and 15% of the share of the vote, which is a very good figure. So he's got a coalition of left-wing groups, including the old Communist Party, but all the groups as well. And he's trying to go it alone, along the line that's interesting, a kind of declared populist line, left-wing populist line, that is, to oppose the right-wing populism of Fillon and Le Pen. That's really the sort of tactic of Mélenchon. But in general, the left is in disarray, very weak. Never seen the left wing in France so weak, so fragmented. So, of course, one of the consequences of a very, very, very weak left is that the whole of the French political game has shifted to the right, if not the far right. This is where we are. I've never seen that before. Let's talk briefly about the French right and Fillon's victory last week. I think that the French right has ceased, in my opinion, to be distinctively French, in a sense. There was a kind of... the French right was always... French conservatism was always different from, say, the Christian democratic right in continental Europe, or sort of conservatism like you find in Britain, more of a free marketeer type of right, believing in state interventionism, and also moderate in terms of societal issues. I think if you look at, I think it was very much in the news last week, Fillon's platform, by French conservative standards, this is very, very right-wing. And to start with, this is very right-wing, or if you consider that right-wing when it comes to the economy. This is an absolute 20 or 30 years now after the Thatcherite revolution in this country, this is what he's trying to do. You might argue Sarkozy tried that in 2012, before 2012, with some success, at least in terms of implementation, but this is really a harder version of what Sarkozy tried to do, for instance. It goes very, very far into dismantling what's left of the French social state. You can't argue in France, seriously, that there hasn't been any reform in a sense of deregulation, flexibility. That's all what Hollande has been doing over the past 5 years. That's why he's paying the price politically. He's completely alienated his own electorate on that. So it's going very far. Just one figure, you know, 500,000 jobs will be slashed in the public sector. I don't think this is going to be very popular when the French actually realize that, if he wants to do it. I don't know if he's going to do it. Also, I don't think this is a very risky tactic to appeal to a more working-class popular electorate, which is, as you know, probably tempted when it doesn't abstain to vote for Le Pen and the National Front. That electorate will not regard those proposals, economic proposals, very positively. Do I have to say? I think I'm going to skip the point about populism. We might talk about that if you're interested in our debate. But just to finish on France and Europe, this is today's topic, after all. I think when it comes to Europe, I think the warnings have been there. The sort of red lights have been clinging for a while in France. In 1992, as you were saying, already France narrowly voted in favor of the Maastricht Treaty, but rejected, alongside our Dutch friends here, the Treaty on the European Constitution in 2005. And since then, gone are the days of France being, as you know, together with a close partner of Germany, you know, thinking ahead, having plans for further European integration, the deepening of a political Europe, of a social Europe, which is a very French expression translated into English, it rings a bit strangely, social Europe, and also where you had almost most of the political class, from segments of the far left to the conservative right, not the far right, of course, who were self-declared federalist. France was a country for a very long time when you had lots of people who, of course, Delors, Mitterrand, but that's over. I think what is really striking is the lack of debates, plans, and really about the future of Europe. Few debates. In the public, there's there's a steady rise of Euroscepticism. Talks like in Britain about recapturing national sovereignty, allegedly lost Brussels, but in along different lines. There's no UKIP leaders or Boris Johnson, Michael Gove leading the show here. It's more, although Le Pen is there, but Le Pen is quite clever. Le Pen, it's not, she's really careful about the way she sort of stand on Europe is, you would say, almost sounding like a left-wing one. It's about Europe and globalization have dispossessed, you know, the workers of a number of their rights. It's a Europe of business. It's a Europe of markets. There's nothing for us there. Very interesting the way she does that. Whether she's genuine or not is another thing. But that's very much the debate in France, you know. And that's the sort of, that was the debate in 2005 when the referendum was rejected.
Okay, Philippe, I think I might
I'll leave it there.
Stop you here with the last question, though. Does this mean that if we're not looking at a likely President Le Pen, but maybe now we've seen the increased popularity of Fillon, even though it's not an anti-EU platform he's running, we still see some of the values that Michel outlined as the core European values being challenged by him? He has a very different position on Putin, on questions to Turkey, even to Trump. What could we expect with France within the EU, but with such a position in global politics?
Yes, you're right about that. I think Fillon strikes me as being very lukewarm with regards to European integration, as was Sarkozy, by the way. Hollande was allegedly pro-European, but hasn't done much there. So he's lukewarm, and also there seems to be at least now a kind of shift toward the sort of traditional pro-US or Atlanticist stand and pro-EU stand to something which is more critical on the EU, first of all. And secondly, yes, Fillon is talking now about better establishing better a partnership with Putin's Russia. That's new. Remains to be seen whether what he'll do if he's elected president, of course. But what he can't do is probably, like any conservative prime minister, when conservatives in this country are in a position, they normally are quite critical of the EU. Once they get elected, they are, you know, the EU is there. I think he'll do the same, probably. So don't expect him to rock the boat. But clearly, he is not very enthusiastic about the EU, that's for sure.
Okay, thank you so much, Philippe. Bojan, to you, I think what a question that many want answered is whether one of the bastions in Europe will remain and whether Merkel will be in a strong enough position to, if not keep things stable in Germany, then also even in the rest of Europe. What is your take on the upcoming German elections, please?
Well, good evening, first of all. I just wanted to say, as I was coming here on the Eurostar, I was slightly concerned that I will be confronted with some sort of optimism about Europe. But I'm glad to say that my pessimism will blend in nicely. First, I'll offer my own answer to the question, to the title of our panel. I think the answer is no. The EU will not survive next year because the UK will activate Article 50, thereby initiating a process of leaving the European Union. So the European Union as we know it will then cease to exist. The second biggest economy, the second biggest population, the first, the strongest military power will have departed quite soon after that. So that's something to think about. I'm very grateful to Philippe for painting this, for sketching this kind of gloomy outline of what's going on in France, because this is it's very important to know that in order to understand what will happen in Europe and what is happening in Germany, and also with regards to German leadership. As we all know, Germany is the preeminent country, and Angela Merkel is the preeminent leader in Europe. Is it too quiet?
Yeah.
Okay, sorry. Basically, the German elections will be, she's seeking a fourth term in office, and it will be a complicated election because there is an opening on the right to her party, the Christian Democratic Union, which basically was created by Merkel's migration policy last year. There is a party called Alternative for Deutschland, the Alternative for Germany, which was originally established by a bunch of economics professors who were not happy with the euro, the currency, and the measures that Europe had taken to preserve it. And last year, this party reinvented itself as an anti-migration, anti-Islam party because of the huge influx of people that arrived to Germany. You can't trust the polls, we've learned that, but I think the estimates are that they will win about anything between 12 and 20% at the election in September or October. I don't think they've set a date yet. What that means is that it will be very difficult to establish a two-way coalition. Germany now is ruled by a grand coalition of the Social Democrats and the Christian Democratic Union and their sister party, the Christian Social Union from Bavaria. So the likelihood is, if the AfD, the Alternative for Germany, does well, the likelihood is that there will be a three-way coalition. And that's not good news for Germany, and certainly not good news for Europe, because the Grand Coalition has been difficult. Governing Germany has become slightly difficult because of the opposed ideological and you know other positions that these two parties have. If they were to admit another party, for example, the Greens, which is a likely outcome of all this, then would have a bit of a mess. And domestically, with regards to Merkel's leadership, she herself, I think, referenced that now famous article in the New York Times, which I think Sarah was referring to, that she is the last standing leader to defend Western values after Brexit and after the election of Donald Trump. But she herself said that the notion of that is absurd and grotesque. So I think she's quite right. We have to trust her on that. Internationally, well, in Europe, her authority has been severely diminished with the controversy around the euro crisis and especially with the controversy around the migration crisis.
People can't hear, they say.
Can you hear me now? Mm-hmm. Sorry, I'm just speaking away from the microphone. Basically, last year when Germany had was facing extreme migratory pressure, the Chancellor basically bulldozed through a scheme in Brussels, a so-called relocation scheme, to share the burden of asylum seekers. And this was done against the will of the other member states, but especially against the will of the Eastern European member states, notably the so-called Visegrad 4 countries, which are Poland, the Czech Republic, Hungary, and Slovakia. But also other countries were opposed, and of course France was certainly opposed with what Philippe was describing. The last thing they need is now a large-scale migration from the Middle East. So this was politically really difficult. She needed it at the time, but it really did poison the well in Europe. And I think her authority and her leadership has suffered for it. And I don't think it will be easy for her to generate consensus the way she was able to before, and especially on Russia, as we've heard now, the likely future president of France has a very, very different position on Russia and on the sanctions against Russia. These sanctions, they only came into existence because Angela Merkel was managed to rally support. She went around capitals. Nobody was really willing to sort of damage their own economy by introducing sanctions over Ukraine, but she managed to create consensus. After Fillon would become president, this will obviously become a very complex issue, and she will not have the same authority to go to capitals such as Budapest and seek support for policies like that. Also, Brexit will have changed things immensely because Britain and Germany, for all their differences on things like the freedom of movement, what we call in Europe the freedom of movement is the right of citizens to move and find work or just move to other countries of the Union. In Britain, that's called migration. So the concepts are different. And I think, anyway, Britain and Germany are natural allies. Britain, it's on its way out. So the way to generate majorities in the European Council will change drastically, and not necessarily in a way that would help German leadership. So I think it's very likely that she will be chancellor again, because her rival, Martin Schulz, who is otherwise known as the president of the European Parliament, before that he was a mayor of the small town of Würselen, I think it's more of a village, near Aachen. So after that kind of role in national politics, he became an MEP and has been MEP for 30 years now. I think the difference between them is about 8 percentage points, 9, 8, depending on the polls. She's got greater support, but I think as we approach the election date, I think the support for Schulz is not necessarily a known quantity in Germany, so it's unlikely that he will be a serious challenger, serious rival. So she will be chancellor again, but this will be her last term. Her authority will be severely diminished, and with Britain on its way out, kind of managing Europe will become ever more difficult. Now, what I know from her, from one of her, she holds these briefings for foreign journalists once a year, and I think in 2013 she invited us to Berlin, and this, or 2012 maybe, and this was the height of the euro crisis, and everyone was worried about what will happen to the common currency, what's happening in Greece, what's happening in Spain, etc. But it was interesting that the only thing she wanted to talk about was France, because this was the first year of François Hollande, and one of the things he did was to undo the tiny little reforms that Sarkozy had done before him, and one of them was kind of lowering the pension age again. I think this was 2012, or don't remember exactly. And anyway, she was very upset about that, and she was basically saying that it is impossible for Germany and for herself to provide viable leadership in Europe if France is not playing a key role. She was very wary of talking about a kind of leadership of Europe as ruled by Germany. She said it's absolutely quintessential that the motor of European integration, Germany and France, stays functional, and she was very, very worried about France's inability to reform. And her prognosis at the time was very gloomy. And as we're seeing now, I think 4 years have passed, we've seen very little structural reform in France. And Fillon is greeted as a Thatcherite, but people forget that Sarkozy was saying the same things before he got elected the first time around, and not much changed. So it's unlikely that we will see something substantial changing in France, and that is the big problem in Europe, because of his recent history, Germany is simply not able to provide the kind of leadership that France was able to provide in the last decades, and these countries are no longer equals. France and Germany are no longer equals, as Philippe noted. And there is a certain vacuum which now a diminished Merkel will not be able to fulfill. So I think it will be very difficult dealing with the rise of populism across the continent, dealing with the problem of the Eurozone, which is kind of muddling through, but huge challenges are bubbling underneath the surface. We've got this arcane referendum on Sunday in Italy, which has upset the markets. And again, the worries about the Euros have come to the fore. You know, 10 years ago, people wouldn't have even noticed, because it's even difficult to even understand what the referendum is all about. But what people understand is that it could cause Renzi to resign, and this will destabilize Italy, and that it would destabilize the Eurozone as a whole. So I think dealing with the Eurozone, dealing with populism, dealing with Russia is a massive challenge. Dealing with America, with President Trump, who is threatening to upend the post-Second World War order, to pull out of NATO, to question arrangements that we have taken for granted. We've got huge challenges ahead, and I don't think Germany will be able to respond with some sort of great leadership, as everyone expects.
Okay, thank you so much, Bojan. Indeed, quite a prospect for not just Germany, but for all of Europe. But of course, there are other countries to also look to, and we would now hear from Agata on the Polish position in such a big changing context, because of course many would argue that this means that there is a core and periphery, and where do the different countries sit, but perhaps there are also opportunities in that. What do you think is the perspective for Poland?
Thank you very much for the invitation to this panel. I'm afraid that I will offer you another portion of gloomy news. What a surprise. I would like to focus on a year ahead of Poland, and it very much chimes with what my colleagues have already said. Although Poland itself is not facing elections, in fact, it's actually the current government is celebrating the first anniversary of being in power ever since it's won the outright majority for the first time in the post-communist communist history. The elections that we just discussed about will have, in my view, well, actually, they might determine the course of the Polish European policy and its foreign policy more broadly. But before I focus on those challenges on the international and European stage ahead of Poland, let me please very briefly comment on the domestic challenges, mainly because those challenges will also have probably, and the activities of the current government in Poland, they will have repercussions for Poland's standing in Europe. So as you may be aware, in the election campaign in 2015, and it looks like ages ago already, the Law and Justice Party positioned itself as a party of all Poles, as a party of ordinary people. I guess it sounds quite familiar to the British people these days. Law and Justice Party is a socially conservative party, very much sort of supported by the Catholic Church, but economically it is left-leaning. And if you follow the campaign, you probably have heard that at that time still the candidate for the prime minister, Mrs. Szydło, who is now a prime minister still, she promised that the government would lower the retirement age, something that we also faced in the French debate, that the new government would introduce more generous family benefits, that it would give the tax rebates, that it would encourage all those brilliant, bright young people living in this country to come back home. But there is one problem with this. There is always very difficult to implement the electoral pledges. When the government, when Law and Justice Party came into power, it faced these problems. It started from introducing its very flagship a project, which is called 500 zloty plus, which means that the government is paying 500 zloty plus, which in accordance with the current exchange rate is slightly less than £100, for families with, for every second and subsequent child to every family, no matter what the incomes they have, and is also now introducing, trying to reverse unpopular, but in my view, necessary pension reforms that the former government just introduced and is now actually reversing the increasement of the retirement age. Now, the problem is that those reforms, they do not very much solve, in my view, the problems of the Polish aging population, but in fact they put public finances at risk. And bear with me, because there will be the link with the European policy in a second. According to some experts, you know, this program, this 500 zloty plus program, could trigger around 30,000 birds annually, whereas Poland has around 150,000 birth deficit annually. So it doesn't very much respond to the problem of the aging society. Now, the government thought that it could finance some of its very generous reforms by, for instance, introducing the tax on the large retailers, by a better execution of the taxes. But again, the European Commission has very clearly signaled, in fact, it actually started an infringement procedure against Poland by saying that such a retail tax would be a violation of the current EU rules on the state aid. So, and hence, it actually effectively made Poland to suspend those reforms. Now, I mean, it's no good news for the government, because in order to keep your electorate happy and to continue paying those 500 zlotys, you need to find money for this. And also the news from the National Statistical Office are not very optimistic. The economic growth is slowing down, and also the investment the investment level has decreased. This made many experts really worried that Poland could be actually entering on the path of so-called excessive deficit procedure, that it's very well known to most, actually, member states. For those who do not know what the excessive deficit procedure is, this is the procedure that the European Commission launches when a member state is at risk of breaching deficit threshold of 3% of GDP, or when the its government debt level is above 60% and is not falling at a satisfactory level. Now, Poland has just exceeded, actually, this procedure. And there is a real and some worry that actually it could come on this collision course with Brussels again. Another problem that Poland has been facing, the current government has some difficulties, for instance, in managing the EU funds and in spending those funds, which, as you may know, makes it in a sort of weakens its negotiating position whenever the next multi-annual financial framework will be negotiated. So this is the so-called this is the domestic stage which could put Poland on the collision course with Brussels. And as you may know, the sort of relations between Brussels and Warsaw are already tense because of the unresolved dispute around the constitutional tribunal, but I will not be dwelling into it because it's, even for me, it's already quite complicated where we stand. What I'm trying also to say is basically, if the excessive procedure is initiated, I don't see very much room for sort of Commission's flexibility, also because the Commission is now really disappointed with Poland's actions, with the fact that it has failed to, for instance, implement its recommendations on the rule of law procedure, which of course could at some point also fuel Eurosceptic sentiments in Poland. You know, even though Polish society is still quite pro-European, I think, like many other nations, Poles do not really like when bureaucrats are actually telling them what to do, and this would be probably the case with the excessive deficit procedure, or if the Commission decided to take further actions around the rule of law procedure. Now, this leads me to the second half of my presentation, which is probably more interesting for you. These are the challenges ahead of Polish-European policy and foreign policy more broadly. Now, If you look at 2017 for Poland, for Polish European policy, it will be very much about Brexit negotiations on the condition that actually Theresa May triggers Article 50 by the end of March. Warsaw was, and I think actually also other Central European countries, to bring also the broader perspective, I think that Warsaw was really disappointed to see the outcome of the referendum, actually to see Britain going. You know, the current government actually has seen London rather than Berlin or Paris as its major ally. It has shared its vision of Europe, it has shared its distrust to Euro, to ever closer union notion, whatever it means really. And it also sits with the European conservatives and reformists in the same political group. So this is why perhaps some in the Polish government, I think, have still believed that, you know, if they push for the reforms which would suit Britain, perhaps Britain won't leave at all. There is a problem with this, because perhaps apart from Viktor Orban's Hungary, there is very little appetite for the vision that the for the vision of Europe that the current Polish government represents. And actually, you could see it during the Bratislava meeting, that the Polish government was the only actually government sounding out the possibility of the treaty change. And even the other Visegrad countries, apart from Hungary, you know, said, well, this is too much, we are not going to support it. So there are also quite growing divisions among Visegrad countries, and it seems to me that Czech Republic, but also Slovak Republic, they seem a little bit uneasy with the fact that very often they are put in the same basket with Viktor Orban's Hungary and the Law and Justice Poland. So that's about Brexit, and I actually think that, and please let me know when I should stop. Already?
Yeah.
Okay. I still have like 2 points to make. Okay, I will be fast. I just want to say that mainly because Poland has seen Britain as its major ally, it's probably also going to offer a helping hand in those negotiations. It's going to go extra mile to accommodate Britain's concerns. You could probably, I think that actually the recent visit of Polish Prime Minister to London very much reflects this willingness. I think it's going to be a tricky strategy to put all the eggs to the British basket, mainly because Britain is, in fact, leaving the EU, whereas Poland needs allies from within, inside, who would simply help it articulate its interest as the EU is entering the uncharted waters, you know, with populism on the rise and with the increasingly assertive Putin's Russia. Poland needs allies mainly because it's not certain, it's not for granted that post-Brexit Britain will be plugged in the EU's security and defense policy, and that it will have a say on sanctions policy. And also Poland needs allies perhaps because there are growing sort of tendencies to approach or basically to adopt this rapprochement with Russia. You know, it's not only Italy that it has been sort of articulating that we should normalize relations, but these are actually all presidential candidates in France. I see that I have to wrap up, right? Oh, okay. And perhaps because you also asked me whether, you know, there's this sense that there's a growing fragmentation in EU, and where does Poland fit into it? Indeed, this government has a totally different vision of European integration. It positions itself as a non-Euro country. And I actually think that whereas Berlin used to serve as this bridge for Poland between the Eurozone and the rest of the EU. Now this has been very much undermined after the new government has taken over the power, and you know we cannot exclude that in 2017 there might be at some point a tendency to sort of for the Eurozone to drift away from the rest, especially if Mr. Fillon, I think, becomes the next president. Now, to answer the question also on the 2017, whether the EU will survive. The EU will survive. It will, in my view, I mean, the shape of it will depend on the result of the elections in France, Germany, but also the Netherlands. And I think that Poland under the current government might be very much isolated in this EU and will have to deal also with questions, you know, concerning, for instance, free movement of EU workers, something that, you know, the questions that it feels very uneasy about. And I will stop here because Sarah has been very strict and making me really nervous now. Okay, and I can also pick some questions later on.
Thank you very much, Agata. So Poland, of course, not a country with its own elections during 2017, but perhaps one of the countries which will still be most affected by the other countries' results. Anan. A cheerful note on Britain, or is that utopia? I would expect so. But please tell us, what is your take? Granted, what's happening on the continent, will the position for the UK actually therefore also be changed quite drastically to what we're looking at right now?
Well, I mean, what I find very cheery is we spent an hour talking about the EU and hardly mentioned Brexit, which I find to be great fun. It's been mentioned in passing, but not as much as in general in this city of late. I mean, it's pleasing, but also salutary. I think there's a tendency in this country to believe that, you know, on those rare moments when our partners aren't negotiating with us, they're thinking about us. And actually, what we've heard about the domestic politics, with the possible exception of Poland this evening, is that, you know, everyone is as self-obsessed by their own politics as we are. And we shouldn't fall into the trap of thinking that everyone around Europe at the moment is worrying about us and how to please us. And I think that might be a trap some of our ministers are falling into at the moment. For what it's worth, I agree with Philippe. The only way the EU collapses is if the Front National win in France next year, and that's probably unlikely. So what I'm going to do is very, very briefly, and I'll stay within my time so we've got time for Q&A, try and address two questions. What does Brexit mean for the state of the EU, and what does the state of the EU mean for Brexit? Brexit is bad for the EU. It's bad for the EU partly because of what Bojan was saying, that the EU loses one of its most powerful member states. But it's bad for a number of reasons. It's bad because it will take up time, when Lord alone knows there are enough issues to take up the EU agenda already. European Council meetings are going to have to address Brexit. European civil servants are going to have to be talking about Brexit at the same time as all these other crises are going on. Brexit will be divisive. Because the one thing we do know about our government's negotiating strategy, running commentary or not, is we're going to try and play divide and rule with our partners to get the best deal for ourselves. And that's not the best thing that the EU can have at a moment of profound instability within the Union itself. One specific area where Brexit could be calamitous for the Union is in discussions over the budget. I mean, discussions with the UK over the EU budget are going to be bitter enough when it comes to the question of how much we finally owe before we're free, and that number seems to go up every week according to some leak report or another. But they'll be divisive in another way, because of course losing a net contributor means that the remaining member states have some difficult decisions to make about who makes up the shortfall or who loses some programs. And I suspect it's in the area of budget where we will first see some really corrosive effects in the EU of Britain leaving. Let me say one final thing about Brexit in this way is, you know, you sometimes hear express the hope that once we've gone, everything will work smoothly. That's just nonsense. It's nonsense, one, because, you know, if you take defence, which seems to be the area other EU member states are thinking they can make progress in when we're gone, other member states have always talked a good game when it came to defence. I've never really seen much practical political desire to make things work on the part of the Germans or many other member states, and I remain to be convinced that with or without a British veto that will change. And secondly, because the two main issues that afflict the European Union at the moment, which are migration and the Eurozone, Britain hasn't been stopping the solutions at all anyway. Those problems will continue as they were before we go. To cheer you up even further, let me just say that the one thing worse for the EU than Britain leaving at this point would be Britain staying. Because for those of you who sort of think, oh my God, maybe we can avoid this in some way and Britain will stay, that will be a car crash. It will be a car crash because Britain is a country whose population has voted to leave and where the government is very sensitive to popular opinion. It will be a Britain that stays in the EU on terms worse than it rejected in its referendum because there's no renegotiation on the table anymore. And it will be a Britain, for instance, that will never, ever, ever politically be able to agree to another EU budget. So for those who think that actually the way to strengthen the EU is to persuade the Brits to stay, I'd say think again. That really isn't the case. So what does the state of the EU mean for Britain? I'll try and do this in a couple of minutes. It means several things. One, the political crises across the EU means we're kidding ourselves if we've got 2 years to negotiate Article 50. The French won't negotiate for at least a month while they're campaigning, nor will the Germans. The Germans will almost certainly take 2 to 3 months, given the state of the polls, to actually get a government together after their election, when they won't be able to negotiate at all. We are going to lose 5 or 6 months because of politics out of the 24 that Article 50 gives us, because of politics in other member states. And that's if all goes well. Okay, that's if the results are to our liking. If the results aren't to our liking, then all bets are off. At the same time, it is a reasonable assumption that there will be a refugee crisis or a Eurozone crisis at some point during the next 2 years, which again will mean that we face that situation that David Cameron did back earlier in this year. He turned up at the European Council to talk about Brexit. They talked about immigrants and refugees. They talked about the Eurozone. And then in the famous words of one EU diplomat, David Cameron provided a commercial break for 5 minutes. We're going to get pushed off the agenda, however desperate we are to keep negotiating with our partners. And finally, it's worth saying that the politics of populism that we've heard about here provides very little incentive for many member states, particularly the French or the Dutch, to see us get a sweet deal, because that will be used by their opponents at home. Why would a centre-left, or more right, well, actually impossible centre-left, but a centre-right president, even after an election, start to make Brexit look appealing to the Front National? There has to be a clear signal that if you follow these people, you are leading our country into a worse place than it is now. And I think for a combination of those reasons, I won't keep going any longer because we've only got about 20 minutes for Q&A. Brexit will be bad for the EU, and the state of the EU will make Brexit very, very messy indeed. I hope that's cheered you up.
Thank you so much, Anand. This is the status we are looking at right now, and this is without having considered in any detail what could happen even this weekend in Italy in Eurozone politics. But I won't ask any more questions. I will now open the floor to you, because I'm sure with such a wide-ranging set of topics, you will have burning questions yourself. So in the front to start with.
Richard Bronk, European Institute. I wanted to ask Philippe particularly about France. You seem to be moderately optimistic that Fillon will win, but if you have a Thatcherite candidate facing a populist far-right candidate, how do you mobilize the young and the left to actually vote?
Okay. Very good question. Yeah, we'll take one in the back. Okay, we'll take both of them, so yeah.
Hello. The French President François Hollande has just announced that he will not run in the 2017 presidential election.
Sorry?
Hollande isn't running.
No. Just now?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Breaking news. Thank you very much for
the information as well.
What do you think that the position of the left candidate, who do you think the left candidate could be, and what does that mean for Europe?
Okay. Yeah, and last question before we go back to the panel and take another round afterwards.
It's amazing.
John here. Yeah.
It's John Pete from The Economist. I wanted to ask the question you just touched on, Sarah. The consensus seems to be the only real risk to the EU is Marine Le Pen. But what about Italy? I mean, if Renzi does lose and we perhaps have an election, there are parties in Italy that want to put the question of whether Italy should stay in the euro to a referendum. Do you think that Italy is a serious risk as well?
Okay, thank you. I think first we take the French position, and then Boyan, if you want to say something on Italy. Yeah.
Yeah, in the case of a Fillon-Le Pen contest in the second round, which seems likely, but who knows now? You know, volatility, as I said, is a key thing, and we might have some upset and surprises. It's a very good point, I agree. I think I said Fillon's strategy is risky. I said that in my presentation, in exactly for that reason. You can't mobilize the young, the working class, those who are rejecting Hollande, on the ground, not that he hasn't reformed, but he has reformed in a free market way and has, you know, made their situation worse as a result. And I think this is risky because he will lose, of course. He will need, in that case, a fraction of the center-left electorate to show up to vote for him, as well as the centrist, you know, the Bayrou electorate to also support him. They might defect if, you know, it goes too far to the right, at least economically, because that kind of electorate will hate that. And, yeah, but still I think, you know, the polls were showing that the margin, the gap is still wide enough. But she'll do certainly better than her father in 2002. That's really the thing. So it's sort of making gains. But I don't think she's got enough still now to do it. But caution again, because it's amazing what's going on. It just changes all the time. Hollande will not run. Well, that confirms it's really sensational news, because apparently the thing was that he wanted to declare his candidacy if he was running again in December. Well, we're in December, but mid-December. So he sort of, that clearly confirms what I was saying, how weak he is. That's it. You know, he's just absolutely no way. It's sensational news in a sense. We've never seen in the history of French politics, at least since the end of the Second World War, a president after 5-year terms finishing so badly. It's just absolutely amazing. Of course, we'll have to reflect upon that. But and the left is in complete disarray. I think no one can on the left. There will be even 5 to 7 candidates for the left, from the far left to the socialist candidate. No way they can qualify any of them to the second round.
About Italy, on Italy, yeah.
Well, spot on your question. Italy is a great case study of the polycrisis kind of mode that Europe finds itself in. Two major problems. The biggest one, obviously, the Eurozone, the common currency. The second one is the Schengen. These two projects are failing, and failing badly, because they're incomplete, because they were hastily put together, and because what needs to be done for them to properly work, and especially the common currency, and your newspaper has on numerous occasions pointed out the measures that need to be taken for it to work, but unfortunately it is impossible to do this because there's no consensus, there's no sense of community in Europe. The Finns in Lapland do not feel as a nation, they are able to support the economies of southern nations like Italy or Greece by introducing some sort of permanent transfer systems. So what happens in Italy, we have this constitutional referendum, and Renzi, not very cleverly, has tied his political fate to it, although nobody really knows whether he will resign or not. But he has said that if the referendum fails, he will resign. If he resigns, likelihood is that the five-star movement probably will take power. They are a populist kind of, I suppose, left-wing, you could say, group led by a clown, literally. He's a former clown. Not like the rest of them, but, you know, professionally speaking. And what they will do, I mean, obviously, it's an unknown quantity. The markets will go crazy. We've seen during the euro crisis that the markets have an issue with Italy. And if we were to go back 2, 3, 4 years in time and have this volatility, the European Central Bank will have to step in. But the problem could become so huge that it would be difficult to resolve. So I think the fragile nature of these arrangements is very, very exposed on the example of Italy. So I think, that is certainly a huge issue.
But presumably also with Germany and elections forthcoming, Merkel will be forced to actually come out and take a position on this.
Oh, it will be extremely difficult. It will be complicated. I don't understand enough about Italian politics to know what will exactly happen and whether he will even resign, because some people have questioned that as well. So we just don't know. But if a major crisis were to erupt ahead of the German elections, you know, she will be in an increasingly difficult position. She would have probably to pledge some sort of, you know, some sort of, essentially, she would have to say that German taxpayer money would change hands, and that's not a popular thing to say at the moment, because, you know, already the migration crisis or the refugee crisis will cost Germany about 15 billion euros a year. So we're facing an extremely difficult situation. So all bets are off, I would say.
Yeah, but it's also really boiling down to that every time we now seem to have either a referendum or a big public decision on EU questions, it's not just concentrated to that one specific question any longer. I wanted to say that
obviously everyone's focused on the UK referendum, and it is the most important and the most significant one. But let us not forget that in 2015 there was a referendum in the Netherlands, in the Netherlands 2016 in Denmark there was an arcane issue of whether Denmark should transfer some powers to Brussels in order to be able to continue to participate in the cooperation around Europol, which is the European version of Interpol. And Danish voters just refused, although the government advised them that this is necessary. It's a small thing, it's a small price to pay for this valuable cooperation. Danish voters just refused it. Same thing in the Netherlands. Dutch voters were asked to vote on whether to approve an association agreement with Ukraine, and over which there was a civil war erupting in Ukraine over that issue, and the Dutch, who lost over 100 people in this terrible incident over the Donbas and the plane crash, they voted against it. So every time there is a referendum, anything remotely linked to the European Union, voters in the founding members, the Netherlands is a founding member, are very eager to reject whatever issue is put on the table. So EU's approval rates are abysmal in Italy. So we'll just have to wait and see whether people will take this as an opportunity to vent their frustration.
Okay. Yeah. I'll take another round of questions now. Yeah. So the gentleman here.
Thank you. My question is for Professor Menon. Could you please expand a bit on your statement that Britain leaving is bad, but somehow if Britain were to remain, it would be worse? Could you give a little more detail on that? Thank you.
Okay. There was a hand at the very back over here. Yeah.
To what extent
it's not on.
To what extent is the fact that living standards haven't increased since the 2007-08 crisis, certainly in the UK and I presume across Europe and across the world, to what extent do you think this is the factor not only in the rise of the right but a disillusion with Europe?
Good. Do you want to say something? And down here in the front, please. There's a lady here in the second row. Yeah.
Hello. You all mentioned the refugee crisis, and I was wondering how can you address that issue? Because on the one hand, as Mr. Van Holten mentioned, you must promote the Western values of the European Union, but on the other hand, when Angela Merkel tried to do that with a measure to open borders, she weakened as a leader. So how do you deal with this?
Okay. And the last question here in the front. Then we take the very last question here from the gentleman.
Hi, good evening. In terms of the background that you've painted, where there'll be a complete lack of cohesion in Europe, what happens when there's a banking crisis in Italy and the entire system falls into, let's call it shock?
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. And then I think if we start with you on the Britain going or leaving, going or staying.
Yeah, well, the reason I say that is if you think about the politics that would result from a decision to stay, you'd get a UKIP bump. We have a government that is largely Eurosceptic now anyway. Many Remainers have become leavers for tactical, if no other reason. You'd be in a country where there would be a massive amount. I mean, let me give it an assumption here. The assumption I'd give is that the economy hasn't tanked before we leave. Okay, if the economy absolutely tanks before we leave, then who knows what will happen to public opinion and therefore politics. But my assumption is it won't, not least because we won't feel the effects of leaving until we've left. So the timing's slightly wrong that way around. Okay. Under those circumstances, if you consider what politics did to our approach to the European Union before the referendum, and multiply that by a pretty high factor given a strengthened UKIP and the sense of disillusionment around, and the fact that if anyone in this country knows anything about the European Union now, it's that we give an awful lot of money to it for not very much reward. That's what everyone thinks they know about the European Union. It just strikes me that the notion that, you know, straight after we've made this decision, we're round a table discussing the next multi-annual budget framework, I cannot see any circumstance at all in which a British government could approve it, unless we weren't a net contributor, in which case I can't see anyone else approving it. So I just think, you know, we would just, you know, the Britain of before June of this year would come to seem like Belgium in the European Council compared to the Britain that would retake its place down the line. And I think that would all be because of the way the politics drives things. And I'm not sure that's necessarily what the European Union wants or needs at the moment.
Yeah, okay, Agatha.
Thank you. I don't think there was any question directed to me, but actually I would like to take this opportunity and argue with Anand about this, because I have an impression that you also suggested that there is no willingness, or there won't be a willingness within the EU27 actually to keep Britain in, just in case it changes its mind. I mean, of course, the question boils down to whether the article notification of Article 50 is revocable or not. I think, you know, we know the government's opinion about this, and actually this is the view that has sort of resulted in the situation that the government has to deal now with in the Supreme Court. But, you know, in my very humble view, there is really nothing in this Article 50 to prevent Britain from changing its mind, even if it starts the negotiations. And it's also difficult for me to imagine that if Britain comes and says, well, actually, the circumstances have changed so severely that, you know, would like to stay. I don't see European leaders saying, no, now you've made up your mind, you have to leave. Of course, it will very much depend on how advanced the negotiations are and how what kind of approach Britain takes and what kind of sort of message it strikes. But I think you know, I would slightly disagree with you that there is now no appetite, basically, to keep Britain in just in case it changed its mind.
Okay. Thank you, Agatha. Philippe, maybe you could address the question about the lack of rising living standards, because obviously the prospects for a lot of people in France, as you have painted a picture, that there are very few opportunities for certain groups in society, and this now plays out in the elections. What is your response to that?
Yes, you're right. It certainly impacts on people's attitude and the way they relate to Europe. The big debate in France is not about Frexit, France leaving the Europe altogether, but it is directed at the euro. The problem is the euro for the majority of French people now. The euro isn't functioning well. It's not functioning to the benefit of the people. You know, it's not a good thing. It's not well run. That's the sort of idea. Started off on the sort of fringe politics, far left, far right, but now it's sort of gaining momentum and also impacting more on more mainstream leaders. So this is the kind of thing which you find now. Yes, of course, since the crisis, but even you might argue before that, one of the failures of Europe is to really be seen as a sort of a construction which will enhance, you know, living standards, create jobs, growth, and etc. That's really a thing. It has become, to be fair, a bit of a scapegoat for all the ills of, you know, national ills, but a lot of things, we saw it with Brexit, people criticizing the dismantling, the demise of the welfare state, whereas, you know, a lot of it has to do with national politics. It's not Europe in command of that. Clearly, a bit of scapegoating, so it's a bit unfair on the EU, but overall, this is about the failure of Europe really delivering on what it was supposed to do in terms, you know, jobs, growth, economic success. And that hasn't really touched the people. It may have been good for business, may have been good for a number of firms to do commerce, but it's certainly not very good for people. That's why now this sort of European dream is really no longer a dream, but a bit of a nightmare to a lot of people.
Yeah. Thank you. Okay, Michael, Merkel and values, that must be for you.
I think it's a good question. I think that, and there's a big debate to be had about it, but I think that, in essence, Merkel was absolutely right. I mean, said and did the right thing. But there were two problems. She said it without having a plan on how to implement it, and either didn't know what the consequences were going to be or wasn't prepared for them. And also, she did it without consulting other member states first. And, you know, she knew or would have known that implementing her noble words would require agreement for the other member states. And in any Europe, especially today's Europe, you need to negotiate that and agree on that beforehand. And we've seen the consequences of that not happening. I think people were reminded of the fact and scared a little bit as well about the fact that you have this large member state which feels like it can tell the rest of Europe about how things should be done. So very laudable aims, but not put in practice very well. But I think, you know, we do need people like Merkel. I'm glad she's running for re-election. I'm a social democrat, but if I was German, I would vote for her, because we need leaders like her, or Europe will fail, and they will make mistakes. She made a mistake on that count, I think, but on the whole, I think she's made a massively important contribution to Europe. And I think one point I would like to reiterate is this notion that we shouldn't get lost, or we shouldn't sort of be made to believe that the whole debate about Europe is only about the question of whether we send more power to Brussels or bring more power back, etc. It is also a deeply ideological discussion about what kind of society we want. And a lot of the enemies of working together in Europe are people who don't believe in the role of government at all, and who would like to see less government, both at the European level but also at the national level, who believe in a different kind of society. And, you know, that's also part of the explanation, I think, of why the Dutch voted against this Ukraine agreement, because the people leading that campaign are, on the whole, very right-wing or very left-wing ideologues who have a very different vision of society than the mainstream. But people somehow came to believe that this is all about a question of power, less or more power for Brussels. So we need to be very aware of that, and people who have a view on that should make themselves, should get engaged in that debate and be clear that of what is at stake.
Okay, thank you, Bojan. You always wanted to come in on this.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to disagree in the strongest terms. I think what she did was morally maybe sort of right, but it was an utter disaster for Germany and for Europe. And I think we see that's the case, because then immediately in the immediate aftermath, she engineered this horrible deal with Turkey. And as we speak in Turkey, border guards shoot at women and children trying to cross from Syria into Turkey. This is exactly what's happening. It's documented, and it's with the tacit kind of approval of Germany and Europe. So we've come to that. Germany is also leading more or less secret negotiations with Egypt to set up asylum centers, sort of Australian-style asylum centers, where they would push back people who come on the boats. They would turn the boats, send them back to Egypt, and keep these people locked up and give them an opportunity to file for asylum, and then reject it and then send them back to wherever they came from. So we are now, you know, moving towards a very, very harsh policy, which, you know, which is a direct result of this this chaos that happened last year. So I think a humane solution is no longer on the table. You know, we're not even able to create normal policy anymore because of what happened last year. Also, if you look at the statistics, according to Eurostat, 29% of the asylum seekers that that were registered in Europe in 2015 declared themselves to be Syrian. That's about a third, and a lot of them didn't have identity papers on them, so presumably they were not all of them were Syrian. So that's not a huge number. So a lot of these people were, in fact, you know, not necessarily you know, driven by you know, reasons that would make them qualify for asylum legally in Europe. So a lot of them were just people looking, you know, seeking better life. And I think in the present climate, where a lot of people will say that Brexit essentially happened because of what was going on in Europe at the time, there was an unfortunate coincidence with this, you know, people watching television, this kind of chaos, borders all open. And I think migration is a huge issue. We see that in the rise of populism in Germany itself. We see that obviously with Donald Trump. Here in Britain is all over the media and the political discourse. And I think, and certainly in the Netherlands, Sweden, Finland, even everywhere. And I think, you know, I think governments need to take note, and mainstream political parties need to act before it's too late. Because we've had in Germany, in one federal state, the Alternative for Germany win 24% of the vote. So, you know, from 0 to 24% within a couple of years, that's astonishing. And that only happened because of the migration crisis and nothing else.
Yeah. Thank you, Bojan. So obviously, a topic we can't go into much more depth with, although it needs it, because we are now past time and we haven't actually responded to the very last question on the full-on banking crisis. Would any of you give one-line answer to that one question, and then I will wrap it up here. Any answers to what happens in a banking crisis situation?
Well, I mean, I'd say two things. I mean, firstly, for me, the crisis that might happen in Italy is economic, not political. I think the centrists will muddle through whatever happens in the referendum. What they do in the event of a banking crisis, I just do not know, because there's a very clear standoff between Rome and Brussels stroke Berlin about the way you deal with the Italian banks, and neither side is willing to blink. And given that the Germans have got elections this year, they will be, I suppose, even less blink-prone. I just do not know how that gets resolved. But, I mean, Italy's got a very particular political problem with small shareholders in banks, which makes it just an absolutely inflammatory issue there, and Brussels is showing no signs of being sympathetic to that at all. So they've got themselves into a bind, and I don't know the answer, quite simply, I'm afraid.
Okay. We will have to finish here, unfortunately, but I think the answer to our question for tonight, will the EU survive 2017? There is a question mark to it, and certainly there's a question mark to, if it doesn't happen next year, what are the repercussions of domestic politics in the years to come? 2017 will absolutely be defining for the path for Europe in quite a long time ahead. But please help me by thanking the panel for tonight, and please do follow our work.